Hi, Thorn Podcast listeners. This year, we're celebrating our fifth season. As we prepare new and exciting conversations on the latest topics in healthy aging, sports performance, and the future of wellness, we'd like to hear your thoughts about the show and any ideas you'd like to see explored on future episodes. You can fill out a short survey by visiting thorn.health/pod. As a thank you for your feedback, you'll be entered into a drawing for a $100 Visa gift card. We'll select two winners each week until the survey ends. So the sooner you enter, the better your odds. Go to thorn.health/pod for your chance to win and to get your voice heard. That's thorne.health/pod.
This is the Thorn Podcast, the show that navigates the complex world of wellness and explores the latest science behind diet, supplements, and lifestyle approaches to good health. I'm Dr. Robert Roundtree, Chief Medical Advisor at Thorn and Functional Medicine Doctor. As a reminder, the recommendations made in this podcast are the recommendations of the individuals who express them and not the recommendations of Thorn. Statements in this podcast have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Any products mentioned are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Thorn Podcast. Joining me this week is Jeff Chilton. He's a master of mycology and the founder of Namex, a company that supplies businesses like Thorn with high-quality mushroom extracts for use in dietary supplements. Jeff, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell our listeners about yourself, and in particular, how do you get to be a master of mycology?
Well, you know, probably one of the best ways is to live in an area that has lots of mushrooms growing in it. And I was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest. Mushrooms were around me my whole life. When I went to university, I was at the University of Washington. And you know, there's very few universities that actually have a mycology department. My field of study, though, was anthropology, but I did study mycology while I was there, and I put the two together into ethnomycology because I was really interested in the use of mushrooms by peoples worldwide for food, for medicine, and in shamanic purposes. And look, Bob, the 60s were full of a lot of shamanism. So you have to understand that that was part of our culture back then. So mushrooms were a real part of my life then. And then when I left university, well, what do you do with a degree in anthropology? Well, not a whole lot of jobs for that. But so I decided, well, there's a mushroom farm that's 60 miles down the road in Olympia, Washington, the only one in the state. I was there for the next 10 years, literally living with mushrooms.
Wow. So you lived and breathed them.
Oh, let me tell you, I loved every minute of it. And this was a very, very large mushroom farm. It was primarily an agaricus farm. So we were growing about 2 million pounds of agaricus a year. But we had a Japanese scientist there, and he was growing shiitake, enokitake, and oyster mushroom. And so I was able to see these other mushrooms being grown. And so it was just a wonderful time for me to be there to learn as much as possible. Every week, we were generating 320 tons of compost to feed the crops that we were growing down there. So it was a huge operation on a very large scale, but I was just reading as much as I could get my hands on, read a lot more about functional or medicinal mushrooms. And that ultimately was where my career, the path it took.
Cool. Well, that segues nicely into the topic for the week, which is mushrooms. And I will say, I just had my sauteed shiitake in my eggs this morning. And
oh, my favorite mushroom.
Yeah, I eat shiitake actually several times a week. So that's how people often think about mushrooms, right? They maybe see them in the woods, they see them in the grocery store, and then a smaller percentage in the West really think about using them medicinally. Medicinal fungi, I guess, is the appropriate scientific term for that. So, you know, again, a lot of our listeners, when they think about mushrooms, they think about pizza, right? Or they think about spaghetti.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that when I was at the mushroom farm in the 70s, classical nutritionists said mushrooms have no nutritional value. And why did they say that? Well, because mushrooms are very low in calories. But the fact is that mushrooms are fabulous foods. They have a reasonable amount of protein, 20 to 40%. They're mostly carbohydrate, but that's very slow acting carbohydrate, like mannitol, trehalose. So very slow digesting. They do not have starch as their carbohydrate. That's for plants. No, mushrooms have these other carbohydrates, and half of those carbohydrates are in the fiber. So mushrooms are very, very high in fiber. And as you know, besides the fact of what it does in terms of our digestion, it's also feeding our microbiome. So I'm constantly telling people, put mushrooms into your diet. They're a fantastic food. I call them actually the forgotten food and the missing dietary link. I mean, this is something where in Asia and other parts of the world, they have appreciated mushroom for thousands of years. We've really kind of lost that appreciation in the West and now just are rediscovering it. So put mushrooms into your diet. And if there's only one mushroom, make it shiitake. It is fabulous. It's such a wonderful mushroom. And not only is it a wonderful edible, but it's got amazing functional value to it.
You know, I, a number of years ago, was in Beijing, and the hotel I was staying at had a restaurant that was a fungal restaurant. Every single thing on the menu had some kind of mushroom, and I'm not even sure I would call them mushroom. I mean, they were strange looking shapes, you know, things that look like ladders. Very odd looking things. And it just occurred to me, they have such a different concept of mushrooms or fungi in Asia, in Japan and China and Korea than we do here. I mean, what do you think that's about?
Well, you know what? I think what it's about to some degree is food is medicine. Those restaurants, I've been to a couple of those because they are in different parts of the country there. And, you know, it's pretty amazing that they can create all these dishes. And you look at their dozens of dishes that they've got with the different mushrooms in them. But I love that concept. And I think, as you know, I mean, our diet is the foundation of our health. And so you really have to have a good diet, and what you put into your body, if it gives you not just that nutrition, but it has this other functional value to it, well, that's really what we want to be doing. We don't want to be consuming things that are taking us in the wrong direction. We want something that's going to enhance our health. And I think mushrooms are a perfect example of that.
I guess I'd have to say that most people, when they think of mushrooms, they think of, is it Agaricus bisporus, right? The button mushrooms that you get, you know, in a standard grocery store, and not the shiitake. Can you say something about the difference in medicinal potential of different mushrooms? It seems to me like the button mushrooms probably have the least medicinal potential of any mushroom out there. You know, they're the most popular in this country, but again, compared to shiitake, there's a range, in other words.
Oh, yeah. You know, even when it comes to nutritional, I mean, every mushroom has got a different medicinal profile in terms of nutritional profile. And look, I lived with the button mushroom for 10 years. I actually still love eating it. I haven't let go of that. It's a wonderful edible mushroom.
It tastes great.
Oh, yeah. And believe it or not, they've had tests on it. It does have medicinal properties in it as well. I mean, every mushroom in its cell wall has compounds we call beta-glucans. And beta-glucans are part of the fiber in mushrooms. But there's been a lot of research on the beta-glucans. And the beta-glucans are what provide us with what I call immunological potentiation. And that's really what mushrooms are giving us. That's the primary thing. And every mushroom has these beta-glucans in their cell walls. The difference is that these beta-glucans have different structures. So they're all what we call a 1-3-1-6. That's how they're put together. And the 1-6 is the branching, but some have a more effectiveness than others. And those are the ones that we look at as kind of, let's just say, the top 10 mushrooms that we consider highly functional in their activity for us and where there's a huge body of research. Whenever I'm talking about mushrooms to people, that to me is the primary thing that I talk about, because mushrooms potentiate our immune system. They sit in the background. And when we are challenged in some way, they come forward, they will activate different immune cells, whether it's macrophages or T cells, NK cells. That's what their function is really. And, you know, I tell people too, don't think that when you take them today, whatever you're taking them for, tomorrow you're going, oh my God, I feel so much better.
Yeah, those mushrooms are just, it's not caffeine.
No, it's not caffeine. So, you know, the point is you have to look at them like a vitamin. You have to look at them as something that you're taking every single day. You're incorporating it into your diet. And it's not something where, okay, I can take that aspirin, I can take that ibuprofen and my inflammation or pain, an hour or so, it goes away. No, they're there, they're sitting in the background, just like you would take vitamin D, for example. No, that's how you should look at eating or supplementing. And the first thing I tell people, eat mushrooms first, put them into your diet. And then if you want a supplement, fine, go ahead and supplement. But it's really important to put them into your diet.
To eat them. So we keep using this word mushroom. I'm hoping you can offer us a scientific definition of mushroom, i.e. fruiting body. And like, what's the significance of talking about these things as mushrooms or mycelia? You know, what? Why would anyone care? Why would the consumer care about mycelia?
Well, yeah. And look, you know, it's interesting because as a mushroom grower, it's like mushrooms don't have any seeds. Okay, so how am I going to grow mushrooms? There's no seeds. Well, mushrooms have spores. Those spores in nature, they're out in the wind currents. They land on the soil. They land on wood. When conditions are right, those spores will germinate into a very fine filament called a hypha. When multiple filaments come together, they will form a network. That network is called mycelium. Mycelium is what we call the vegetative body. It is actually the thallus or the body of this organism. When conditions are right, that mycelium, which is out there and it is consuming organic matter, and look, it's very important for our ecology. It's part of this repurposing of organic matter ultimately into humus. So it's one of the players in that world. When conditions are right, it will produce a very fine little knot of mycelium, which develops slowly into a mature mushroom. And when that mushroom matures, it will produce spores and it will complete this life cycle. Now, this fungal organism in this life cycle, as consumers and looking for supplements, we want to know what the part is. And with plants, we'd say, what's the plant part? Is it a root? Is it a leaf?
Yep. Above ground, below ground, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so the point is, okay, with this fungal organism, we have spores, which in China, believe it or not, they will collect the spores of reishi mushroom and they will put them through a process they call cracking. And they will crack these spores and sell them as a supplement. And look, I've looked at it. Don't bother. Yeah. There's a lot of hype around it. And people are making tons of money selling these things. And one reishi mushroom, believe it or not, can produce as much as 400 grams of spores.
There's money to be made there.
There's money to be made there. Yeah. So you have the spore. You have the mycelium, which is the vegetative body. You have the mushroom, which is the fruiting body. So those are our three plant parts: spore, mycelium, mushroom. And this is so important because there are companies that will grow the mycelium on sterilized grain They'll grow it on there for 30 to 60 days. It coats the grain with this. And for people who have never seen mycelium before, mycelium is a, if you've ever seen a mold growing on your bread, it starts out kind of as a white, and then next thing you know, it turns green or black, which is the sporulation of this mold. But a fuzzy white filaments, that's what mycelium looks like. It will coat this grain, and again, they do it, it's all done in a laboratory. They will then take it out, grain and all, and they will put it into a dryer. They will dry it out, grind it to a powder, and then sell it to you as mushroom.
Mm-hmm. It's and, not mushroom.
Look, it is not a mushroom. In fact, what it is mostly is grain starch.
Starch.
We actually did a analysis. We put it on a chart, analysis of the grain it's grown on, and a lot of them will grow on oats or rice. And then we took the nutritional analysis of the mushroom itself and charted it on there and charted these mycelium on grain products on there. Those products where they're growing this mycelium on the grain charted nutritionally exactly like the grain it's grown on, nowhere close to the mushroom itself. And again, this is something people have to be really aware of. And look, there's nothing wrong with mycelium. It's not like mycelium versus mushroom. There's nothing wrong with mycelium. If it's a pure mycelium, which they grow a lot of in China in liquid culture, tons and tons and tons of it, but these products do not separate the mycelium from the grain. And what that ultimately means is you're buying a lot of starch, a lot of grain powder. And can you imagine, you know, on the front panel, it says reishi mushroom with a picture of a reishi mushroom, and you think you're getting a mushroom product. And if you're lucky, in the fine print on the other side will tell you, okay, what's in this? And it's like, oh, myceliated grain, but they'll have mushroom somewhere else. And the front panel says mushroom. You think you've got a mushroom product, but in fact, you've got nothing but grain starch.
Or cellulose, maybe. I don't know. Like
you could have cellulose as well in there. So you know, it's really unfortunate because if you go into the, whether it's Whole Foods or some other marketplace, 50%, I'm not kidding, 50% of the products in there will be these myceliated grain products. And it is really unfortunate, especially, and this is what galls me the most, you have naturopaths that don't know any better, actually telling people to get these products. And it's just shocking. And we push back on that in a major way. You know, we just filed a citizen petition with the FDA over labeling issues. You have to label your product properly, and they're not doing it. And because of that, you have a lot of people taking what they think is a mushroom product when in fact it's not anywhere close to a mushroom product.
So there's no standardization requirements that say this product has got this amount of beta-glucan in it, in other words.
No, there's not. And look, we introduced the beta-glucan standard into the industry in 2015. And in 2015, I published a white paper where I analyzed 40 of these different myceliated grain products. I also analyzed whole dried mushrooms and our mushroom extracts and demonstrated that those products were low in beta-glucan, about 5%, when in fact mushrooms are 25 to 60% beta-glucan, and they had up to 30 to 60% alpha-glucan, which are the starches, where a normal mushroom with the testing was somewhere below 5%. And what actually it's measuring is glycogen. You know, isn't that interesting? Mushrooms, as their storage carbohydrate, have the same storage carbohydrate as we do. And of course, you know, there's talk out there about how we have these similarities with mushrooms. And it's very interesting because that organism is doing the same thing that we're doing, is breathing in oxygen and exhaling carbon dioxide.
So if you're expecting to take one of these products with low beta-glucan as an immune support, you're probably not getting much.
Oh, you're not getting anything at all. It's really unfortunate. And it's not just the beta-glucans. I mean, if you look at, for example, a reishi mushroom is a biofactory. This mushroom is producing all of these triterpenoids, over 100 different triterpenoids, a few other compounds. The mycelium, even pure mycelium, has very, very low amounts of triterpenoids. So you're not even getting the secondary metabolites with these products. And it's so unfortunate. I mean, the bottom line is, again, it's mostly grain starch, very little, few of the compounds that you're looking for in an actual functional mushroom. And again, we do everything we can to educate people about this whole issue. But, you know, look, it's not killing anybody. So FDA doesn't really care, even though they actually have a compliance document that says you cannot call mycelium mushroom. You can't insinuate that mycelium is mushroom. This is from 1976. So look, and a lot of people think, well, why isn't the FDA getting involved? And it's like FDA is looking for things that are killing people out there or real issues. That's where they step in. But otherwise, no, they've got so many other bigger fish to fry, so to speak. And that's unfortunate, because what it does is it makes people go, oh, yeah, there's no regulation around supplements at all. Supplements are so heavily
regulated.
You have no idea at how regulated they are. But the fact is no, they don't make you test your products for compounds in there or anything like that. If you're making wild claims about them, yeah, they will hunt you down. If you're making cancer claims or some other claims, no, you can't do that. They'll step in. But otherwise, no, they can't enforce anything like the actual quality or the actual how genuine is this supplement product. No, that's not what they're about.
Okay, this is a little bit of a side question, but I want to come back to this. But a couple of years ago, I was in Shanghai, and I went to a traditional Chinese medicine store, and they had cordyceps behind the counter, and these were beautiful. I mean, you know, they're in a little display box and everything, and these things are selling like one piece of cordyceps for $1,000 for one piece of cordyceps. Is there more medicinal value to these products, or is it kind of like ginseng in that you have a beautiful ginseng root and it, you know, makes a nice art display? But is there actually any added medicinal value to these really expensive cordyceps products that you see? I'm not talking about capsules now. I'm talking about, you know, the actual fruiting body that's...
Yeah, well, you know, Bob, I've been to that store. there's probably more than one of them in Shanghai.
But yeah.
And it is interesting. You see, they've made them into these beautiful displays. Sometimes they've got like 20 to 50 of them that are woven into a beautiful looking display, you know, something you'd probably put on your wall rather than, and look, nobody actually consumed those, and what we call caterpillar fungus regularly. They're probably, and mostly my understanding is, purchased as gifts for somebody because nobody can afford them. Nobody can afford it. I mean, I was at Natural Foods Expo exhibiting in 1991, and I was walking around and I was meeting different companies, and I had cordyceps with me, and I said, hey, cordyceps, it's been used for a long, at that time it was $1,000 a kilo. And it was like, what do you think? And I told them a little bit about it, and they just looked at it and they went, you know, our customers are not going to eat caterpillars. After all, they're vegetarians now. But look, here's the what's happened, and which is so wonderful. Cordyceps, this caterpillar fungus, is wildcrafted up in the foothills of Tibet, and people are on their hands and knees combing through pastures looking for these, because the caterpillar itself is underground and all you see is this little blade coming off of it. So they call it winter worm, summer grass.
They
will actually dig this thing up very gently and pull that caterpillar out with that little grass blade like cordyceps that's growing off of it, clean it up, and then take it to market. Well, guess what? We cultivate cordyceps, not that species, but we cultivate a species called Cordyceps militaris. And militaris is a beautiful orange species that they learned how to grow in Asia 10 years ago. So that's what we will sell. And look, when you think about $15,000 for a dried kilogram, our entry level product for cordyceps is a 1-to-1 extract of Cordyceps militaris. We sell that wholesale for $70. So big, big difference there. And they've been using Cordyceps militaris in traditional Chinese medicine interchangeably with Cordyceps sinensis. And my God, today, nobody really, no practitioner is going to be using Cordyceps sinensis in their practice unless they're working with a billionaire or something like that, because nobody can really afford that Cordyceps. I'm not a proponent of wildcrafting at all. Wildcrafting to me, it always ends up in tears. You know, whatever it is gets over harvested. In Europe, in the 1890s, they were harvesting 200 tons of truffles.
Yeah.
Today, they harvest 9 tons of truffles. And a lot of the truffles that they harvest today are coming from tree plantations where they've planted them and they have truffle mycelium on the roots, and takes a long time, but ultimately they start producing. So you can imagine that's what happens ultimately with wildcrafting. And one of the things that we've done recently, we are selling a lot of turkey tail. And turkey tail has really come on as a very strong product, and people are really getting a lot more interested in turkey tail. Well, I'm just like, you know, wildcrafted turkey tail, okay, wonderful. But when you look at them, you know, they've harvested these things. They're all different ages. They could be this year's, they could be last year's. Yep. There could be a look-alike in there. It's just not really a very good way to procure this mushroom. So I went, okay, look, we're going to grow these things. It took us about 4 or 5 years to get anybody actually want to grow them, because the issue with mushroom growing is the harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Every mushroom you've ever eaten has been harvested by hand.
Hand.
Can you imagine that? They're still harvesting them by hand. So it's like with these turkey tails, every one of these things probably weighs less than a gram. One agaricus mushroom weighs 35 grams, one mid-sized agaricus mushroom. So people are just like, oh my God, no, we don't want to grow those because we'd never be able to harvest them at all. We finally found somebody that's growing them. Last year, we grew 10 dried tons of cordyceps that cultivated cordyceps. We're going to grow more this year. We're going to get away completely from wildcrafted cordyceps. And the beauty of it is you've got a consistent product. And that's why I love cultivation. And all of our mushrooms are cultivated, and they're cultivated on the substrates that they would grow on naturally, which means they're going to produce the compounds we're after because the precursors are there in that wood, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
An interesting thing is that most functional mushrooms grow on wood. Mm-hmm. It's really fascinating. Most of them are wood decomposers.
Doesn't the term shiitake mean grows on oak?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. Yeah. Take is Japanese for mushroom. So shia is actually denotes the genus. And so they call it shiitake. And then, you know, look at all the other mushrooms. It's a maitake and nokitake. And so it's kind of cool. I really think it's a great way to talk about the Japanese mushroom.
Well, I think it's time for us to take a short break. So what we're going to do is step away for a second, and then we're going to come back and answer some questions from our listeners. When it comes to your health, your body deserves the best. That's why Thorne invests in comprehensive testing, sourcing the highest quality ingredients, and creating the cleanest manufacturing processes that will provide unparalleled solutions for your health.
It is this approach to quality and science that has earned Thorne the trust of more than 42,000 medical practitioners, as well as 100 plus Olympic professional and collegiate sports teams. It's also why Thorne is the only supplement manufacturer to be chosen by Mayo Clinic for collaborating on clinical research and educational content. Discover the quality and science that leads to a happier and healthier life with Thorne. Visit thorne.com to learn more. That's thorne.com. And we're back. So now it's time to answer some questions from the community. Our first question this week comes from a listener who asked, what should I look for when selecting a mushroom-based supplement to ensure I'm getting a high-quality product? And we mentioned something about beta-glucan standardization, et cetera. Is that it, or are there other ways?
That's very important. Look for a product that gives you a amount of beta-glucans. If it says polysaccharides, don't
look out.
Because polysaccharides are also starches.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Some of these companies can hide behind a polysaccharide, but look for somebody who's giving you an out. We give a percentage of polysaccharides on all of our retail and wholesale products. And the other thing, too, is, you know, look closely in the other ingredients. Some of these companies will actually tell you that they're selling myceliated oats or myceliated rice. So look very closely at that. But certainly look for somebody that's selling something that says, okay, X amount of beta-glucans.
Are there any particular mushrooms that are especially effective for boosting the immune system? So we talked about how beta-glucans do that in general, at least the 1-3, 1-6 linkages do that. But is there one mushroom that really stands out, or are they all good?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is because we test for beta-glucans, we've been able to see which mushrooms have how much beta-glucan in them. And interestingly enough, the two mushrooms that are highest in beta-glucans are the turkey tail and reishi mushroom. Yeah. And both of those have around 50% beta-glucan. It's amazing that those two super important mushrooms, in fact, have the largest amounts of beta-glucan. So definitely those two would be your number ones. And look, just really quickly on this, in terms of, you know, sometimes you'll see companies selling, oh, our product has 7 different species. And then some other company will say, oh, we've got 10, so we're better than you. And then another one says, well, we've got 17.
Yeah,
so we're better, you know, and it's just like this thing of what I call a kitchen sink product. The more species they have in there, the less of the important ones that are in there. My line in the sand is about 5 species. We have one product that we sell. We call it Immune Complex. We have 5 different species. Any more than that, you're just diluting the best ones. And so be aware of that.
Okay. So about 5, a mixture of about 5 is a really
good
one.
That's right. Beyond that. And look, you can also just focus on one or the other. Like you can focus on the turkey tail. You can focus on the reishi extract. But if you want to have something where you have multiple species, no more than 5.
You know, I got to say, thousands of years ago in China, somebody figured out you can rip this rock hard shelf, a monkey's bench off a tree and boil it for hours on end, make a tea and give it to the emperor and the emperor won't die. I mean, that was a gutsy, here, you drink this. No, you drink this. How about you drink this? We'll see if this helps. So, I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that somebody ever figured out that reishi in particular, you know, would have any medicinal value to it. How would you know?
Yeah, I know. And that's almost like, how would anybody know that this caterpillar with this little fungus growing off of it? You must have been pretty hungry.
Yeah. We'll try anything. So that brings us to this next question, which is, well, how do you cultivate mushrooms? What's the process? And is this a sustainable process? So you mentioned wildcrafting, which is depleting species, right? Where are all the truffles going? You know, this is the future, is growing this stuff yourself. Do you grow it in a vat? You grow it in wood chips or like?
You know what happens is, first of all, you look at what it's growing in wild. As I told you earlier, I mean, most mushrooms in the functional space are wood decomposers. Okay, so we're going to either feed them a wood log, like with reishi now, we'll grow it on a small wood log that's about 8 inches high and maybe 4 to 6 inches round. And just so people know, in China, there's no such thing as a wild forest. Everything is planted, kind of like in Europe. You go to Europe and you see these forests. Oh, look at that forest. And then you realize, oh, the trees are all in rows.
Right. They're exactly the same distance apart.
So look, they have what we call wood lots over there. And so they can harvest these trees. They use these small pieces of a round tree to grow reishi mushroom and other particular species and will be grown on sawdust. And this is a very common substrate for growing shiitake, lion's mane, maitake, turkey tail. It will be sawdust plus some nutrient like rice bran. And think about it for a minute. Sawdust. What do you do with sawdust anyway? It's a waste product. Okay, we can use it to grow mushrooms. How about rice bran? What do you do with all the rice bran in the world? We got more rice bran than we know what to do with it. Oh, look, we can put it into the mushroom substrate. Mushrooms traditionally are grown on agricultural waste products. Agaricus, the button mushroom, what does it grow on? People think, oh, it's grown on some kind of manure. No, it's grown on straw, composted straw. All of the straw that's being generated every year in the United States, a large portion of it is growing into agaricus mushrooms. So agricultural waste products are being recycled by mushrooms. So here you have this, let's just say sawdust log. You will pasteurize it or sterilize it. You will inoculate it with mycelium. Again, for a mushroom, they have no seeds. Our seed is live mycelium. We'll inoculate it. The mycelium will grow out over this substrate over a period. It depends. Could be 2 months. It could be 6 months. Once it's fully grown, and the way they do it in China is certain mushrooms will grow well in certain temperatures. So, for example, our shiitake mushrooms, when it comes time to actually force the mushrooms to produce, it'll be November when the temperature is lower. When the mycelium grows out, they want a warmer temperature, so you incubate it at a warmer temperature. In the fall, you take it out of the warm area and you put it on shelves where now it's got cool temperatures, and the shiitakes or maitakes grow right out of that little wood log, which is about 18 inches long, and it's about maybe 4 inches in diameter. And they standardize these things, so they're just turning out millions and millions of these little logs that are already spawned, and the grower gets them, puts them into their house, grows the mushrooms. Again, every one of those mushrooms is harvested by hand. The key here is that you are feeding each species with what it normally wants to consume in nature. Now, you're going to give it a lot more nutrients because what you want is you want a high yield. That's the key thing if you're a mushroom grower. You want lots of them. So that's generally speaking how it's done in the United States or Europe. We will grow in huge warehouses. Everything is climate controlled. It will be your temperature, your airflow, your humidity. Mushrooms need a high humidity. That's why in China, where we grow them, it's in the fall where the temperature's down, the humidity is up. Our houses in China have none of that equipment. They're grown very, very naturally according to the temperatures and the season. What that means, Bob, is that every year we have to give our growers, okay, we want you to grow X number of tons this year for us. So we project how much we need every year because it's a kind of a one and out. So we might want to make sure that they're going to grow enough for us and our customers.
Here's just a kind of random question for you, but do workers that help you with the harvesting and growing seem to be healthier than other people? You know, you're breathing in, theoretically, you're breathing in these spores and you're around these mushrooms, not even just eating them, but just being around them. Is it your sense that those people are healthier? Do you feel like there's a benefit from being a mushroom worker?
Well, you know, the beauty of it, when I was working at the agaricus farm back in the 70s, we had miner's lights on. Because when we went into these houses, agaricus is one of the few mushrooms that doesn't need light to grow. Most people think, oh, yeah, all mushrooms are grown in the dark or something. No, they're not. mushrooms need light to grow properly. So there we were with miner's lamps going into these rooms that were dark, whereas the way we cultivate it, they're cultivated in shade houses. So it's a greenhouse, and then they cover it with, you know, it's like a plastic greenhouse, then it's covered with a shade cloth, and it's in an open environment. So you've got air moving in through there. So the harvesters are not going to get a lot of spores when they're working there. And look, if you're in an enclosed space harvesting mushrooms and there's a lot of spores, spores can cause allergic reactions. They actually have something out there called mushroom worker's lung. And that was from actually mushrooms and growers, workers who were in enclosed rooms. But remember, one of the things about the button mushroom, which is grown in these indoor areas, they harvest it as a button, which means the gills have not shown and have not, the mushroom hasn't opened up, the gills aren't there, they're not producing any spores. And the other beauty of it for the grower is that they have a longer shelf life. So that's really, now you'll see those very big, I don't know whether they call them creminis or portobellos. And so what happens is they'll allow them to grow up to the exclusion of others. So you have like a bed and it's got 50 big, huge mushrooms, and they're getting all of the nutrient out of that bed. In a normal Agaricus bed, oh man, you'd have like 1,000 mushrooms on that bed. In this case, you've got maybe 20 that they allow to get big. They harvest it. So it's producing spores, but again, it's a big mushroom, and that's what your portobello is. Portobello, cremini, and just your standard agaricus, they're all the same.
Yeah, some just people different sizes. Different.
Yeah, well, and different colors. Like the cremini, I think, is the brown mushroom. The standard agaricus is white. So they have a lot of varieties with different colors, but white to brown and in between.
So today we talked about shiitake, reishi, cordyceps, maitake, turkey tail. If somebody is unfamiliar with mushrooms, they're not eating them, they're not taking supplements, where would you recommend they begin? Would you recommend a combination product with, you know, that's got a nice mix? I mean, the first thing you said is eat shiitake. Okay, you can't go wrong with that. But let's say the person wants extra immune support. Where do you usually recommend they start? With a mixture or individual or both?
Well, you know what? I think that if you were going to eat just one, or if you were going to consume just one as a supplement, I would recommend reishi. Reishi is different from all the others in that it not only has the highest level of beta-glucans, but it also has these compounds called triterpenoids. Triterpenoids are excellent compounds. They help with your liver, your circulatory system. They basically provide compounds that the other mushrooms really don't. Now turkey tail has certain triterpenoids, but not the same level. And they're different than the ones in reishi. So reishi to me, and they sort of look at it in China and Asia as something very, very special. And I think that's the reason, because beyond just the immunological component with its high beta glucans, it has these triterpenoids. So I would recommend reishi for sure.
Don't they call that like the emperor or something? Like it's got some like sacred name to it.
Well, yeah, and I also call it the mushroom of immortality.
Yeah.
And the Japanese call it 10,000 year mushroom.
Wow.
So yeah.
It's revered.
It is absolutely. In fact, you see it in their art. You see it in their architecture. You see all sorts of images of reishi mushroom all throughout China. And for those who haven't seen a reishi mushroom, it is got a beautiful ram's horn shape to it, and it is red, and you can polish it up to where it's very, very shiny and very, very beautiful. And you look at it and you go, is this a carving? Is this a piece of wood? What is this? No, it's actually just a dried mushroom that we've buffed up a bit.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, clearly we could talk for a few more days, not just a few hours, because there's so much here. I am going to put in a plug for a book we talked about before the show called Entangled Life. If people want to learn more about the potential of medicinal fungi, they should definitely read that book, Entangled Life, by Merlin Sheldrake. It's just a beautiful book that will really open your eyes to the potential here. You know, the tip of the iceberg is the fruiting by body, and then there's the world under our feet, right, of all the hyphae that are reaching out and touching each other.
Oh yeah, you know, it's interesting because people will walk along a path every day, and then one day they go, oh my God, look at that, there's a mushroom. Where did that come from?
Yeah.
And you know, I tell them, because they say, oh, it just popped up overnight. I say, no, actually, it finally reached a size where you noticed it. And underneath, if you pull it out slowly, you can look down to where it was growing from, and you can see the white filaments of the mycelium there.
All right, folks, that's all the time we have this week. Jeff Chilton, thanks so much for being on this podcast. Really fascinating discussion. If our listeners want to follow more of your work, where's the best place for them to go and find out? In particular, you mentioned that you've written white papers on the importance of beta-glucans, et cetera. Where do they get that kind of information?
Well, if they go to our website, it's NAMMEX.com. We actually have a menu there, education, got a ton of great information. We also have slideshows on how we grow our mushrooms, how we process them. A lot of information there. Come for all of that information and continue your education. We also have a website called realmushrooms.com. There's a ton of great information there as well. So check it out. Either one of those websites, a lot of good information.
Great. Well, thank you everyone for listening today. Until next time.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for listening to the Thorn Podcast. Make sure to never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on your podcast app of choice. If you've got a health or wellness question you'd like answered, simply follow our Instagram and shoot a message to @thornhealth. You can also learn more about the topics we discussed by visiting thorn.com and checking out the latest news, videos, and stories on Thorn's Take 5 daily blog. Once again, thanks for tuning in, and don't forget to join us next time for another episode of the Thorn Podcast.
Thanks again for listening to the Thorn Podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this episode or ideas for future episodes, visit thorn.health/pod to fill out a quick survey. We're entering each respondent into a drawing for a $100 Visa gift card. We'll select two winners each week until the survey ends, so the sooner you enter, the better your odds. Winners will be notified by email. Again, you can find the survey at thorne.health/pod. We can't wait to hear from you.